Om Ajnanati Madanasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Dhena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah.
Prihasta Sangha, December 18, 2014.
Something I've been thinking recently is I've been, you know, regularly meeting with the brahmacharis. Almost every week, actually, we have a nice istogosti. And we all sit together and, you know, we go through operational items. Then we come together and do a lot of hearing and chanting, and sometimes Vrindu Sundari jokes, she's like, you're with them more than you're with the grahasthas. And I just thought Vaisheshika Prabhu and Nirgula Mata, they're such luminaries when it comes to setting an incredible example of Krishna conscious sadhana, as well as just on the example of the wonderful grahasthas. So I thought this would be a nice way to kind of initiate possibly more like a regular type sangha, where there's like a nice support for the grahastha community, because it's as there is in every ashram in life, it's there's purification, there's challenges, and we all regularly need the support, just like the brahmacharis do, right? So I thought this would be a nice way to encourage that, and also maybe just oops.
Hey, that's one way to
make an entrance.
What's that? So on that note,
this wasn't planned.
And so just like a little grahastha empowerment session, and more to come, hopefully, within our community. Okay, I'll be right back.
One thing that stuck with me when I read once Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that the grahastha ashram actually the most important ashram for spreading Krishna consciousness, because grahasthas integrate with society and they have access to people through social events that other ashrams don't really go to as much, and they can have personal impact on people's lives, and it's generally the ashram that we have the most participation in. Over the years, that's been generally the case. And also for personal growth, such an important ashram as well. Because as they say, or as my friend Satyadeva often says, I'm not sure we got this, but your mate is your mirror. And you get pretty much instant feedback from your environment in the grahastha ashram. So whatever mood you're in and whatever you have in your heart tends to reflect back pretty quickly, like so you can learn to be balanced, develop the kind of qualities that Krishna talks about in the Bhagavad Gita chapter 12, where he recommends that we be equipoised and not dependent on the ordinary course of activities and things like that. Over to you.
It's nice to be with you all. Thank you for coming. This is a really nice community. We're always so happy to be here because there's the nice group of brahmacharis, but also there's such a nice community of grihasthas as well. And it's nice to see you supporting the brahmacharis and appreciating their presence here and the value that they give to the community. And then also, yourselves building your lives, your professional lives, your lives with your children and husbands and wives and still, really doing a lot of service. So we always find it inspiring when we come here. So, thank you.
And now we can have some discussion, which could be just thoughts about things that are working well in the Grihastha Ashram, or any questions, or questions or reflections or highlights. Yes.
I have a question. For the wife's side, well, for both sides, but you know, I struggle to find a balance between for the wife a sense Mama. Of being yielding Mama. And I don't want to say submissive, but just yielding to the husband, to the husband's mood, and at the same time being still acknowledging myself as a person who's different than he is, and understanding that maybe the way I think about things is different. And but that doesn't mean it's bad, because it's not the way he thinks about things. And just but somehow taking a step down instead of always thinking, okay, my way is the right way. Or just, I guess, my question's not that clear, but I'm saying I struggle with that.
With what?
With finding that balance of how I see things and how I would do something, and in a situation, and then how he would do something in a situation, and trying to find the balance of when to be yielding and when to actually step up and say, no, I as a person feel that I need to do it this way, or it needs to be done this way, and work together.
How do you do that?
You know, there's that saying, not that it's a battle, but they say pick your battles. You know, the things that are really important to you, that you feel like you need to speak up. And I don't know if you're talking about in the home or in the community, because it's different. Those two things are different. But it is a balance of not losing yourself and being true to yourself. Mm-hmm. And what is your like, if it's in the home, then that's something to work out together. Voicing your concerns or your opinions, and backing it up with why you feel that way. At least at least expressing them. It's not that the feelings and the the way you look at things should go unsaid. It is about expressing them, and we do see things differently than the men do, and it can be a nice balance. I think personally, I believe that a lot of the problems we've had in the movement wouldn't have gotten so out of control if women had more of a voice. So our voice is important, but just how we express it, that makes a difference. But if you really, if it's things you feel strongly about, it's important to express it. I know we do with each other. We don't always agree, and sometimes it's done the way Prabhu wants it, and sometimes it's done. I just go ahead and do it the way I want to do it. But it's after discussion, It's after discussion.
Can you give an example? I mean, you have to give one right away, but if you think about it, it's probably helpful.
Yeah. Well, for, okay, if it's in the home and it's how the home is run, I usually prevail.
Like what?
We don't have to get it.
No, because I'm very submissive. Huh? I'm just wondering what you mean.
Well, I mean, it is managing the household and all. But, you know, again, too, we don't have children, so that takes a big, you know, part of the equation out. But if it's something managerial that's his service as, you know, temple president or something, then, you know, we'll discuss something, but it's ultimately, and he's open to my views and opinions, and I express them, and then it's ultimately, you know, up to him to weigh that along with, you know, whoever else he you know, talks to.
I think it helps also to regularly talk about what the overall goal is in the family, because then it's much easier to clarify on the individual items, you know, what's important and what's not so important, and make decisions based on that. And I like what you said about communication. It's the mainstay of the Grahastha ashram, I feel. Taking time, deliberate time, to come together and talk. And it's not the kind of communication that goes well if you just do it in passing. Means, like, you're walking out the door, the other person's walking in the door, and you take a few minutes to talk. But the kind where you schedule appointment, you know, for an hour, 2 hours, a day, a week, to just figure out what you're doing and why you're doing it. And we find oftentimes that when we get together and talk like that, that it takes about an hour minimum before you can actually start talking, because the world's moving so fast and the thoughts are circling around so much that unless you give some time for them to subside, then finally the real issues start to come out. And when you deal with those issues in a really straightforward way, then it sort of clarifies everything in the household. And it's sort of natural for the cooperation to be there. Do you find that?
Mm-hmm. Like, now it's towards the end of the year, and at this time of the year, we always schedule a retreat, just the two of us, and it's for, you know, at least 5 days, sometimes seven, where it's just, you know, we take time for ourselves individually and to be together, you know, to discuss things, you know, how was the year, what would we like to accomplish in this year. And it's like Prabhu said, our lives are going so quickly that unless we give ourselves that time, then we can't get through the layers, you know, and really talk about some things that may be important that can't come up in the quick pace of everyday living. Whenever he asks me what I'd like for my birthday, it's always, I just want a day with just the two of us, no phones, no computers, nothing. We go to the beach, or we go for a walk or something like that, just to, you know, get away, just to connect. And I find that it's really important, you know, to keep on track, keep the communication open and like that. It works for us.
Other comments, reflections, realizations?
This is kind of continuing on Brenda Sundari's question. It seems like maybe it's beneficial to try and more clearly define our roles in the relationship, and both I guess positively act and defer in relation more to those roles. Like you mentioned that you know, just dealing with something managerial or his particular field of service, you generally defer to him, whereas more household affairs, you know, maybe he defers to you. So is maybe a more defined
I think it's important to have a defined role. But I don't recall us actually sitting down talking in such a specific way that, you know, this is your role, that's my role. It sort of happens in the course of the way we do things. And you know,
I mean, I notice sometimes conflict arises when maybe something's not getting done, and each person thinks, well, that, you know, you're supposed to be doing that, or no, you're supposed to be doing that.
That we do. You know, talk about like who covers what things, and that's evolved over the years, and then we've just come to a consensus about, you know, who covers what kinds of services, whose responsibility things are.
Yes, defining expectations. They say that's the number one cause of arguments or relationship battles, is when the expectations of the person are not clearly defined. One person subtly thinking this person's supposed to be doing this, but then it never happens. So defining expectations.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Define expectations and then manage expectations. Define them is always a good idea, to manage what you expect, you know, from the other person.
And two, you know, once they're defined, it's not like they don't. It's not like it's not fluid, too.
Sure.
You know, right? I mean, in our relationship, anyway, there's fluidity there, as far as, you know, the roles.
I also think sharing the spiritual realizations with each other kind of makes you a little more respectful and understandable, rather than just talking about day-to-day stuff. I found it helpful to me, because then I tend to see, oh, the person I'm with is also not ordinary person, so I better learn how to do it properly.
Is there a specific time you do that, like, or is it just something ongoing that you have?
And sometimes, as you said, it's so busy, sometimes I tend to just not hear properly, and when I hear properly, then I tend to go, oh, this is important too, because otherwise I can take it to a mundane level easily, or just, oh, I don't have time. But when I do, it's like, you know, oh, that's something I can think about, appreciate.
So if I understand you correctly, the taking time to share spiritual realizations, because when you do that, then you start appreciating the depth of the other person, and then you have more respect naturally in your relationship, because you see this is a living, breathing person who's deeply spiritual.
I'm at 0.1% then, but you know, I see that as we do more, come to 100%, then automatically seems to be working. Krishna kind of gives an idea of you need to adjust. So.
Thank you. Let's hear some other realizations or helpful.
I like what you said about like revisiting what the main goal in the relationship is. I know that's something that we've been looking at together a lot lately, and just like trying to, like, what are we trying to do? You know, because eventually that's, it's like, okay, well, you know, we're like living together, we're married, and we're like quote-unquote devotees, but like, what are we trying to do? Like, what's the goal, or like, what kind of service are we trying to do? And then seeing like, where do I need to compromise? And then kind of getting to what Brinda Sundari said, like, what's so important to me, and what can I maybe like learn to compromise with the other person? And then it's like something my mom told me too. She's like, you're just going to have to learn to compromise. She's like, you're so stubborn, but you're going to have to learn to do it. So it's just like some of my realizations lately.
So how would you do that if you were going to talk about a common goal? Or how do you do that?
Well, I'm trying to do it on a more proactive basis, because it seems like it's been coming up in like disagreements where it's like, well, I thought this is what we were doing. Well, actually, I thought this is what we were doing. So it seems like to avoid that, you know, like what you said, is like, you know, setting aside that time where you come together and you try to really get to the bottom of things, not like dig down deeper and then just see like, yeah, maybe this is our goal for like the next year, and try to like proactively establish that, and then that way I can see like, well, this is what I should, this is what I need to start like learning how to compromise on.
Nice point. How's that sound to everybody? Any comments on that? Does anybody do that in one way or the other?
Nobody does it.
I mean, I feel like we used to do it when we weren't so busy.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just, it's really tough.
There's an old saying, which you've probably heard, but it's applicable here. Man's sawing the tree, and it's a dull saw, and a helpful neighbor walks by and says, you know, if you just take a few minutes and sharpen that thing, you'll be able to cut down the tree. And he says, I don't have time. They keep going. And that it's just like in management, the wars are won, battles are won in the general's tent. When the general's really intelligent and comes together with the main leaders and really plans things out, thinks of all the scenarios first, then the strategy is much easier to implement. And the old saying, measure nine times, cut once, and so forth. And it's just so important to take time. We take time for so many things that seem frenetic that cause us to be frenetic in life. But then, you know, to actually communicate with the one that we're working with the most closely in life, it doesn't make sense to not do that. In any kind of organization, if there's not communication, then there tends to be mission creep, where you start doing things you never intended to do because time and the modes just carry you in that direction. And unless you have kind of a clear idea of what your mission is, then you tend to be demotivated also, because so many discouraging things that can happen. And you have to be able to go back and say, you know, why are we doing this again? What's our main purpose in working together? And it really energizes. Just a little bit of time doing that translates out into, you know, so much more efficiency. And I hate to put it in just those terms because it sounds very like clinical or business oriented. But on one side, I always look at a marriage as, you know, there's two sides of it, and one is very much like a corporate merger in a way. You know, you got to look at who has what assets, how do they match, which ones do you have to sell off, and you know, things like that to actually have a really good union. And because working together towards a worthy goal is actually really encouraging and makes everything happy.
You know, one thing I accidentally discovered over time, whenever I visit my husband's work, when I see what he's doing, then it really helps me understand the mission that we're doing together. So, you know, just to go and see what your spouse is doing every day, if you're not together, if you're not working together.
That's a really nice point, and it reminds me of what Tulsi Balabhapur was saying about
appreciation.
You know, appreciating the other person's depth of realization and so forth, and then taking time to go appreciate what they're doing and how much they're doing. Because then there can be a point at which someone's doing so much service you don't even notice it, and then you have some need or demand and say, you know, can you do this, can you do that? And then you don't realize the person's overtaxed. But if you just take a little time and go and appreciate. Do you all know the model called the emotional bank account? Any of you heard of this?
No.
Probably. From me,
yeah.
This from Stephen Covey. We find this to be a very practical way of remembering to appreciate your spouse. And the way he puts it is, everyone has an emotional bank account in their heart. We're sentient beings, so we're sensitive, and we tend to remember things too. Things that didn't happen, and so forth. And so you have to, as he says, keep a positive balance in the bank account. Otherwise, when you make a withdrawal, you're too much, you can be overdrawn, and then there's trouble. So there's a way in which you try to always make deposits, and it can be little things, even like you know, thought, it's thoughtfulness that really, and respect, that makes this happen in a lot of ways. Say you leave a note or something like that, just appreciate the person's coming back, or you know the person's going to be tired that day coming back from work, so you take the time to clean the house, even though it's the other person's duty. So you say, I'll clean the place up, get everything ready, so when they walk in, they'll you know, that's a deposit. What would be an example of a withdrawal? All hands should go up. Yes.
I was going to say, that reminds me of something I always call it the love cushion. It's when you do the little things and in interaction, and then when the hard times do come, that cushion is what you fall back on. You know,
yeah.
You remember the good times and the exchanges, the loving exchanges. So
yeah, that's the same idea.
It's a lot softer when there's trouble.
Yeah. Withdrawal.
The dog doesn't have enough salt in it, and the beans are still too hard.
That's a withdrawal. She cooked you dinner.
So how's that a withdrawal?
You mean a deposit?
No, withdrawal. How's it? I gave an example of a deposit.
So meaning that before showing appreciation, you're already on the negative.
Okay. So tell us a scenario.
So let's say you get back and it's, or you know, I also cook, but let's say like Brenda's on that day she mostly cooks. So let's say I get back and then the doll's actually good, but maybe to my particular taste. So then first thing on my mind, I'll say like, oh, it's not salted properly or something. So it's a withdrawal before saying, hey, looks like a really nice lunch. And then maybe the right time saying, oh, by the way,
pass me the salt.
Pass me the salt. Or just say, oh, just later on, like, oh, it was a great lunch, but just notice maybe the beans, there's a timing, the timing for the time so that it's not a withdrawal.
Right. Nice example.
There's a way to
it.
Do
could
it.
Be something as simple as that. Were you going to say a withdrawal?
Sure. No, I'm just, I was going to say something completely relates to what's happening, but it's different. I was going to say something like, if I get gathered all together, these emotions, the product of these emotions can make us, come to the point where we become attached to the wife, attached to the husband, and this attachment is going to develop into a miserable mode of nature situation. We become attached, we become angry, become deluded, become bewildered, the relationship, I don't know what the heck's going on in it. Mm-hmm. That's the way the modes of nature work, with this attachment. So it's kind of dangerous. So we have to appreciate each other, like above the modes of material nature in order to keep everything transcendental. We've got to be continually, Krishna is the center of our relationship. Husband sees the wife loving Krishna, talking about Krishna, reading Krishna book. That's a plus. But when you hear the wife talking mental speculations and all these things that get on your nerves, that's like, okay, that's an egg. But then, if everything is going on, they're doing their services regularly and doing, following the four regular rules and following, doing things Krishna conscious, and it's easy to have a depth in a relationship because, Krishna's in the center.
I've seen
it. Because it's this, I appreciate you appreciate me, there's that danger of becoming attached, and that attachment's going to break down into misery very quickly.
I mentioned a verse in class the other day from the 7th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is talking about Varnashram, and then it goes into Grihastha Ashram. And the verse says that the Grihastha should be externally attached, externally very attached, and internally detached. And this is sort of the balance, because there's a way in which, just like you have regular everyday needs, you have to eat, you have to sleep. Those aren't spiritual. they're external activities, but nonetheless you have to do them. And similarly, there's a way in which people have emotional needs. They have senses. They have, you know, they have needs to be appreciated and things like that. And if those are completely bypassed for the sake of, you know, well, I'm Krishna conscious, what more do you want from me? Like that. I know that's not what you're saying, but I've seen in the past that that a relationship can go that way, that we're Krishna conscious, you don't need anything else from me. And then that balance isn't there. It's like not eating. Just as there's physical needs, there's also subtle physical needs also for appreciation, for some emotional exchange and things like that. And my realization of that verse is that actually one has to be more advanced internally to be able to be externally attached. And this actually is gone into in a lot of detail in the fifth canto in the beginning about Priyavrata Maharaj, who in the beginning was a brahmachari, and he was being tutored by Narada Muni to give up the world. And then Brahma came and said, we need you to be the temple president. And he said, no way, I'm a renunciate. And then even Swayambhuva Manu came and they convinced him, this is your duty, you have to do it. And the whole section there is about how you can do both. And they told him, you won't become overwhelmed or attached because it's your duty. And that's part of being in the grihastha ashram, is that you have to have that balance. And so when I'm talking about the emotional bank account and so forth, it's not in a way that is detached from the, you know, from the core that you're talking about, which is a point very well taken, because that's the essential aspect. If that's not there, then the rudder's gone. And you're likely, no matter what kind of devices or ways that you interact, there's going to be major trouble. Is that all right?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
So the Prabhupada gave that in the Bhagavad Gita, I think it's Bhagavad Gita, a good example about the woman who has the paramour, but she does her job even more carefully. It's like we're meditating on Krishna and how to please Krishna, but we give so much affection to our family. And I mean, it's there too. There is real genuine affection, because when you love Krishna, then you have natural love for everyone. But it's not like you neglect the duties the relationships. Yeah.
One question is more about the children. So there's like a lot of talk in this community about starting a school, and we have all these young children, and what are we going to do with them? And I know you don't personally have children, but you've been in the movement a long time and seen lots of couples with children. And I guess I'm just wondering, it feels like even within our community there are so many subtle differences about how the children should be raised and what's their experience. Some devotees think they should be very much sheltered and not interact at all with the outside world. And other devotees feel it's better if they interact with the outside world. And just my personal point of view, I'm a teacher, and I don't know so much about the history of the movement, but I've seen that a lot of devotee children are not, grown children are not always able to find their way in the world and balance the Krishna conscious life and the material world. I mean, I don't expect that my children are going to become pujaris and just live in the temple for the rest of their life. So what's your kind of vision for the, because you're talking about how in the grihastha ashram, it's a really good opportunity for preaching. And I mean, this is the future of Srila Prabhupada's mission. And so what's your advice, I guess, to this community about what direction we should take for all these little devotees? Any suggestions, advice?
Want to comment first?
No, you go ahead first. You want me to?
You can start.
Okay. Well, there are those differences, and you know, with
how much you feel like your children should be exposed. And but ultimately, when they have a strong foundation of Krishna consciousness, they're going to be exposed just naturally. You know, it's different if you don't sit them in front of a TV every day, kind of thing. You know, that's a different kind of exposure. But I've seen children raised, you know, completely in a Krishna conscious community, schooled that way, homeschooled, and they do quite nicely as adults. And I've seen the other, where the children, you know, were given more of a exposure to, you know, outside the community, and they do quite well. So it's really individual, and I think the thing is it's comes from how is your Krishna consciousness practiced at home. You know, that you give it a worldly view, that it's not sectarian, and you know, because that's where they will learn their principles, is from you, from their parents. You know, and there may be those rebellious times or all, but that's where they'll learn it. You know, from how the Krishna consciousness is practiced at home.
I like what you said about how they're going to be exposed anyway. And I don't think there's a verse in the Sri Upanishad that says, vidyam cha yas tad vedobayam saha, avidyayam ratum tirtva vidyayam ratum ashrite. Only one who can learn the process of nascence and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. And in the purport, Prabhupada discusses how the two are there simultaneously in our lives, nescience and those who are practicing transcendental knowledge. But then he goes on to say that it's not that we have to cultivate nescience. It's not necessary because we've already done that quite a bit. And that kind of comes naturally. And I'm not sure if that's what you're saying, that these are the two sides. I don't know if I understand the dichotomy completely, but if there's an idea that I have to expose my child to more of the world in order so that he or she will be, you know, like a balanced person or something like that, I agree with Nirakula that it's not necessary because that comes quite naturally. And there's also ways in which children who are taken care of and protected in a Krishna conscious environment very carefully can also get a view of the world. There's ways in which they can go out and see in the course of their practice of Krishna consciousness even growing up. I gave an example at our temple as we're watching. We consider that like a laboratory there. We're trying all kinds of ways to, you know, encourage people at all levels in Krishna consciousness. And with the children, we have a lot of kids there now. I mean, the Sunday school is probably up in the 60s or 70s with that many children. And they all have their own, they have their own projects that helps them interact with the world too. One of them is, don't call the child labor laws on the air, but they have their own Sankirtan team. And I just watch them, you know, it's like 35 of them go out on Sankirtan. And they have their own team, they go door to door, and they're really into it. Some of them count the money, they count the money together, they, you know, they do the inventories, they get the, and then they go out and meet people. And they learn what it's like to interact with people, but in the protection of their service. And I was just writing about this in this book I'm preparing for release sometime soon about Sankirtan in general, and I was seeing how what I call, you know, the kids, they get street smarts. It means they know how to interact with people, they know how to communicate with people, but it happens within the course of their service growing up, and it protects them. They can see the world, they can interact with people and kind of see where the how people are being affected by the modes and everything like that, and at the same time they're Krishna conscious. Seen a lot of great homeschool programs. It seems like an ideal system, especially nowadays. There's so many ways for kids to communicate with tutors and things like that, and they can pick and choose who they learn from. There's a couple out in Washington, D.C., Loka Dyaksha and Vidarbha Sutta. We've been going and staying in their house for many years, watching their son Nimai grow up, and seeing how it's an enviable position, actually, how he gets like the best of all education from all different sides. They'll get the best teachers in the neighborhood, and then sort of piecemeal, you know, those are his mentors, and then he connects with a teacher from Harvard for his writing program over Skype and things like that. And I've yet to see someone come out of a homeschool program really screwed up. They all tend to have this really strong foundation. I mean, I've never seen anything wrong from that side. I have seen from the other side more that kids go to high school, then they get razzed for what their name is, they have to change their name. They start talking to other people who watch television, and they start using language that is, you know, leads them to ask about other things, and they become really exposed to a lower kind of energy. Who is it you've seen that kind of went that route?
Which route?
Who survived? That went out and they sent him out into the world and said, go to high school, go to, you know, all these kinds of things in public. Maybe an example would be good.
Of someone who did well out in the...
stayed Krishna conscious and things.
Well, the one who immediately comes to mind, her name is Sachi. She's a... Now it's a Shamanandi. She's a disciple of Indrajumna Swami. She was raised by devotee parents. And she's got her PhD in psychology. She even actually... while she was in I think it was at the end of high school, beginning of college, she actually kind of distanced herself from Krishna consciousness and explored other religions on her own and came back to Krishna consciousness, and it was her own. She embraced it. She had looked elsewhere and came to the realization that this is the path she wanted to follow. So then it really was powerful. And she's a psychologist, she's a PhD, she married a devotee, she's raising her children Krishna consciously, and she went through the whole. But she had a strong foundation at home.
Well, yeah, I was going to make the point, just to help the devil's advocate, that if we were to say that no one could become a devotee by being exposed to those things, then practically every one of us in this room would be an anomaly. We were all in incredibly different positions and low in the modes and everything, and somehow or other we got that kripa and were able to come to Krishna consciousness. And I like what you said about making it your own. And I can take that even for myself, you know, making Krishna consciousness my own, and just really appreciating it in reference to all the other options out there. But especially with the kids, I can see the value and the benefit and the, all that to keeping them very protected, like a fragile plant, you know, watering very carefully and giving them the right amount of everything. Again, you know, we would all be anomalies if it's not possible to become a devotee.
That's true. I do find that a lot of the people that come to Krishna consciousness nowadays take a long time to take up the principles, and they tend to not be very steady. I mean, the general fare we get from universities nowadays, because the acceleration of Kali Yuga is so great that young people are exposed to things that we would never dreamed of when we were young. And so just from sampling the field out there of what people are exposed to,
yeah.
I mean, I don't think that it's... my main point was it's not necessary as a strategy to expose them to the outside world,
right,
so that they'll become, mm-hmm. you know, more Krishna conscious because they'll see the difference or something like that.
Right.
It'll happen. My point is more that it'll happen naturally, and then it can be engineered. You should expose them to the world, but through, you know, the Krishna conscious lens. That's more what I'm saying. But your point is well taken also. That brings me to another point I wanted to bring up about the whole idea of giving free advice, even though I'm not a parent. And that is that really what much of what the Bhagavatam is saying, because if you're a parent or any other kind of guru, you really do have to take a detachment pill, because you can't control everybody and what they do and how they turn out. And there's so many stories in the Bhagavatam. Chitraketu is there. Then you have Marajanga who had Vena. I mean, Marajanga was a pure devotee. He should have had a pure devotee son, right? He didn't. He had the worst kid who ever lived. And, you know, he killed his friends for playtime. And so these things happen. And Prahlad Maharaj also, I mean, throughout the Bhagavatam, Prahlad says, parents can't save their children. He makes this stark statement, Bala Sineha Sharanam Pitaro Nishinga. You can't protect your child, he says, unless the Lord sanctions it. So along with the whole process, one has to be aware of the fact that this is a soul passing through. I'm going to do the best I can and invoke Krishna's blessings. And one other point about this thing about independence, there's a paradigm. Again, Stephen Covey had some really useful knowledge about this. He talks about how there's a cycle many people go through, starting with dependence. And generally, living entities don't like that so much. Especially in the material world. And then there's a certain point at which they want to become independent. And after independence, then they get their own impetus to come back, and then it's called interdependence, and that's when they're really strong. And how many times have we seen children grow up in Krishna conscious who are sheltered, who are taken care of, everything, given every advantage, and then at the age of 16, that's around the time, when I remember, I was telling my parents, you know, what do I need you for? You know? We just raised you for 16 years. We didn't get any sleep, you know? And they're like, I don't need you. You know, what did you ever do for me? And that, it's just sort of a hormone that comes out. Yeah. And then with Krishna, with kids who grow up in Krishna consciousness, they hit that age. And it's actually not necessarily a bad thing. You know, they go out and you can't stop them anyway. And then, you know, to keep a loving connection with them and support them no matter what happens. It gives them an opportunity as a soul to really say, I want to do this. And like with Shyamanandi, and it's so many others. I mean, there are scores of kids who grew up in Krishna consciousness with a lot of advantages, Krishna conscious children, that they were given all the advantages of a Krishna conscious household, who just split. And then they decided and they came back. And once they come back, they're there because of free will, and then you can't stop them. It's their own desire. So those things are helpful to mix in when you're considering all the different options. Nothing's foolproof, as Nirkula was saying. It can go either way, no matter how you do it. But it is important to have some kind of plan, and, you know, overall to this sort of organized for education, because it goes such a long way when they're young to have an organized system of giving them every opportunity to come in contact with Krishna consciousness. You were going to say something.
No, just along this line of children and something you were bringing up about the withdrawals and the deposits, and also how the ashrams, I'm not sure exactly said it like that, but like an institution, you have to regularly coordinate times to meet beyond just like the operational level. And so sometimes with the children, it's such like a major part of like the household operation, mm-hmm. right? And so there's so much energy going there. But like you were saying, like that blade, I don't have time to sharpen it. Mm-hmm. And then also how just by setting the example as the parents, so it's a real art. Sometimes we discuss this that we don't, it's like in the village life, you'd have your aunts and uncles and everything, you know, sisters, and that art of really regularly establish, like you said, every 21 days, establish your mission, whether it's with a community or the ashram, or that the household ashram is an institution as well. And I can see, at least for myself, it's, you know, there's so many other duties. And what to say if it's not even duties, it's other interests in life can even overtake one beyond even just maybe like dutiful responsibilities. And then slowly it just like, you're in the building, like members of an institution, but there's no, you're operational stuff going on, but there's no synergy. There's no chemistry. And that's when things are really like on shaky waters as far as breaking. But it's interesting because the children, they're animate. You know, they're like personalities in the family, which you're putting so much energy into, but then with each other, it's so crucial to maintain that. And yeah, it's that important element. So, yeah.
So you were saying, if I understood you correctly, about reestablishing your purpose regularly, and you were referring to something I brought up from a book I read about how the Bible says that whatever mission you have, you have to reiterate it, reestablish it amongst the group or the family or the company at least every 30 days. Otherwise, people start inventing their own missions and going different ways. That
yeah,
was one thing
yeah,
you said.
Yeah, and so then when you walk by each other, there's that, when you're in the flow with someone, there's a certain intimacy that you just, there's a certain trust, fidelity, loyalty that you feel it. It's not, whereas you can sometimes be right there, but it's like very foreign feeling. You can be with 10 people in an ashram or 4 family members or, you know, husband and wife, but it feels like you're just foreigners. Versus if you do that, there's a certain, you know, like you walk by and you can see there's a certain flow, a certain chemistry that's really yoked as far as loyalty, fidelity, trust,
mm-hmm.
you know, versus like, you know, feeling like it's vague and distant and foreign.
That's a really good point. On a practical level, it's something Nirkula and I do frequently. It's just like, you know, hey, do you have 5 minutes? Give me a pep talk. It's like, okay, here's why you're, okay, let's sit down. Take 5 minutes. It may not take lots of time. You just say, take 5 minutes. Remind me why we're doing this. And then it's like, yeah, well, there's this and this and that. 5 minutes. And it's sudden, just emphasizing your point, once you're clear on why you're doing something, it's like a heat-seeking missile. The mind just goes for it, you know, and follows after it. Right, Nirkula?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it doesn't have to be this big thing where you take 5 days off or anything. Although we recommend once a year, at least householder couples should take at least 3 years off.
Sabbatical.
Hey, Christian just spoke through me. Take at least 3 days off. At least 3 days off.
Well, you can bring the kids. You can bring the kids. You can still find time to talk and relate with the kids, right? I mean,
you can stay up a little later on.
Right, because you're not on the schedule.
Set aside other things for that time. You know.
Yeah, it's just the family then. It's just, you know, no outside. You're not doing your job. You're not. You don't have your phones on for everybody else. It's just, you know, you, your family.
Well, and I guess I just want to reiterate within the community, I'm not always around to be able to do it, but having that network amongst all of ourselves to help each other out and allow each other time to take with our spouses or whatever it may be. Again, I am not around very much, so I don't have a lot to offer in that regard, but I don't know, just like to open that dialogue up.
Mm-hmm.
To spend more time.
Yeah,
support each other.
Nice,
like, you know, maybe
support
somebody
like this, but
amongst
continuing on a
regular
basis. Right.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, we're all doing so many overlapping things very, very qualified mothers and fathers and devotees here, and I certainly feel comfortable with my children anyone here. And I want to see that network strengthen as much as possible.
Well, what you're doing right now is a really good idea, having these scholastic meetings, because I've seen communities, they had social gatherings, a lot of social gatherings. Everything looked really good on the outside. But then, meanwhile, the children, and because parents weren't connecting in regards to their family life and the children, the majority of the children at the time were going to public school, and they were bringing a lot of bad habits, including drugs, into the community. And then before you know it, it can become a crisis. And even the very good families, conservative families, they might end up with their children being influenced, because it's just the peer pressure can be so strong, especially if it's a really large community and the majority of the children. And it was a surprise to me that most of the parents didn't know anything that was going on at all until things got kind of crazy. Mm. It was a little too late. So it's really a good idea to keep in touch with each other and keep on the same page and try to help each other to take care of each
other. How much time do we have to reach?
Although it's so important, but we should probably migrate north.
Well, you want to walk away with at least one action item?
Come for me?
collectively, another meeting or something?
Yeah,
like
I think,
that?
I'm just seeing myself. Like I was kind of joking a little, like Brenda Sinder says, yeah, you're more of a, you're a grihastha, but you're like hanging out, you're like counseling and mentoring the brahmacharis like 3 days a week and hours with them and just really embracing, like just seeing that there's synergy there. But I can see that there's been neglect amongst the grihastha, amongst whether they're my peers or the younger ones, and it just seems like it's something important to coordinate. So I also think it's important because, like you were saying, there's a Sunday feast, hey, how's it going, Haribol, and 24-hour kirtan, hey, Haribol, and hey, come on over for some pizza, Haribol, and it's like a lot of Haribols, and then underneath, though, there's a lot of there's a current of dissonance and discord, and then something, wait, what just happened? Everything was going great, and what happened to them, or what happened to ourselves? And I mean, it can be, it can actually oh, that's tragic. I didn't sense that coming, right? So, like you said, the social part of it, everything looks, airy fairy and really nice, but underneath, so it seems like these types of meetings, like it has with the brahmacharis, it kind of allows things to be brought out, and then it even helps develop a little bit more unity within ourselves as a community, and then as partners. Can you kind of go home and say, hey, we need to sit and reflect on what Varshesh Prabhu and Nirkula spoke about, or what we just spoke, for me next week. Let's reflect on that. So I think an action point would be, maybe I'm not the best coordinator in that level, but there was a little bit of input from the others, coordinating some kind of twice a month and once a month sangha like this.
Would everyone, anybody who's interested, meet on a regular basis?
I'm interested in meeting on a regular basis.
On a weekend.
Try it
down. Yeah.
Get together for at least an hour and try it out, see how it goes.
Yeah.
Hour and
a
half.
Yeah, like when we do the Brahma, we do a little kirtan for 15 minutes and read a shloka, and then we kind of open it up to
Would someone besides
Tushta
organize it?
anyway, something we can email out. And
no, why don't you just see if you can do it now before you walk away?
You can pick second Saturday of the month.
Do you have a and we find we can't just legislate something like that the second Saturday of each month because, there's so much else. Programs come up, festivals come up, things like that. So what we do in our community is we have, in the beginning of the year, we sit down and we have a community calendar all the MSFs get on the calendar right in the beginning of January, going and visiting the cow, programs for the cow, the Vedic Academy, when are we going to have the children's picnics, all the whatever community things you have going on, start with a community calendar. So I would suggest that that be the next thing you do, maybe, is as a community, have a community in the beginning of the year and have a community calendar, you know, when you can see when the festivals are and when you can then put these on there. And then they become official, kind of, you know, not kind of, they do. They, you know. Does that sound like...
Yeah, and...
Does that sound feasible and practical?
I
can take it up, but I, when I'm out of commission, then somebody will have to take over.
Yeah.
I think just why don't you start one step at a time? Don't like think of it such a big thing. Why don't you take the responsibility for scheduling the next meeting?
Sure.
Figure out a time. Is everyone connected in one place on one email list? So... Pardon me?
We can.
Okay. I think that the next step would be to connect everybody in on one group, maybe even start a Google group for Grihastas, like, you know, Denver Grihasta Vision Team or something like that. Can somebody do that? I mean, this is a suggestion. Then everyone can sign up for that. Then it becomes really a much easier task to coordinate the meetings.
Yeah, I can do that. I had one just quick question. When we do start things like this, then some devotees start feeling, oh, I was not included, or I was excluded, and they start feeling bad. And then you start saying, okay, this is open for everyone. And then when a lot of devotees come, sometimes it starts to get derailed, the purpose. You know, everybody brings up their own different agendas, and then the vision is sometimes lost when the teams become too big. So how do you decide how to, like, okay, this is focused meeting for this, if you're interested, just, we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but this is just for this purpose.
You have to set the parameters. We've had this experience with these kinds of groups. You have to set the rules ahead of time. There's no, it's no sniping allowed, no derailing, and you can make a few definitions that this is what the group is for. They do it on Facebook all the time. I see people start groups and they say, can't do this, can't do that, this is the purpose of the group, and then they start. And if you define it and say that, and if there's a problem when it comes up, then you can redefine it and say, starting next time, no yelling, you know. Whatever it is you want to do, it's your group, you get to define it.
And it's probably a good idea to have maybe a facilitator to help it keep on track, and maybe even have just one or two topics for the night, and then people who are interested in those topics come, or, I mean, that's just
And then you can keep saying, you know, stick to the topic, we're not going to deal with that other thing right now, something like that. So, if I understand correctly, you're going to start a Google group and get all the names of the devotees on here, and then what about getting a date for the next meeting, which will...
So once I have the group, I can send some options out and wherever I get the largest... we're going to do the calendar. So probably...
You could. That's a big job. I mean, it takes all day at least. Just for the Sankirtan, we take like 6 hours to figure out, you know, what are all the dates for the whole year for our monthly Sankirtan festivals. So it's a huge job. You can't do it in an hour, that's for sure. So you can do that.
But as the community has gotten bigger, we've just had to include everybody in on that.
On the calendar thing.
On the calendar. Because otherwise, then these kind of meetings don't happen. So it's just kind of from a practical. It is a big job. But
I was thinking we could have at least another one of these kind of meetings to get some momentum somewhere in the beginning of the year. Everyone can come back together, maybe talk about vision for the year or something like that. Or have a brainstorming session. These are a lot of fun, and it's really positive. You get a whiteboard, you put it up, and you just ask everyone their open ideas of room for improvement in the Grihastha community. And then you list everything. Nobody's ideas are rejected. Whatever it is, put it up there, and then afterwards you all look at it, and you agree, what are the top 7 things on this list of 50 things we just came up with? Then you can just delegate it out and say, who would like to help achieve these things? And if you make tiny little advancement, little incremental improvements every time, you get something really wonderful. So we got something.
Good question. It seems like, you know, when we have groups like this, or there's been other kind of like initiatives, it's like when, you know, like senior devotees like you are here, it's like, you know, you gather like literally the entire community here, and there's a lot of enthusiasm, you know, to like hear from, you know, senior devotees, and really like there's some enthusiasm, but it like fades real fast, you know, when there's, you know, like the next time when it's like, oh, you know, like Vaisheshika Prabhu isn't going to be there to like input, you know, and so everyone's kind of like, well, yeah, that's not really that high on my priority list, and then maybe like people don't take it as seriously. So how do we keep like enthusiasm or kind of like the seriousness of this, you know, kind of like everyone's here and no one really wants to go, everyone's really fired up that this is happening right now, I feel like this is great, but I, you know, how will this keep going?
Well, you can always invite senior devotees.
Yeah.
But really, I mean, as much as possible, when people are coming through town, you can schedule it and say, why don't we have a grahastha meeting? Just like we do with the brahmacharis. And I'm sure, you know, when senior renunciates come to town, they sit down in most places and talk to the brahmacharis. You know, you should take advantage. And there's another thing you can do. You can always invite people to have at least part of the meeting to Skype in. That's actually really effective. And people can ask questions and things like that, and then it becomes part of the program. Although I don't think you necessarily have to depend on that if you have a kind of an exciting agenda, which is each time you make sure you walk away with something. You have to nail down, like, we've got an action item that is time bound. For instance, when are you going to have this group together? You have to say what we're going to do, and then by the date it's going to be done. Otherwise, that's what really demotivates devotees in groups, is they come together and they kind of feel like, didn't we talk about that last time? Nobody did anything anyway. But if you actually make incremental improvements, no matter who's here, and you take that system of making sure you get something out of it, don't walk away until you have something on paper that's got a time-bound result, and then it's a lot more enlivening.
And even I remember, like, Kesha Bharti Maharaj, she just, with the brahmacharis, she said, along with, like, your devotees, just come together and hear and chant. And if we do that outside of the social, you know, the Sunday feast social environment, or just the morning kind of program, to have this kind of sangha, and then we actually have a little depth with each other, just like the men's sangha, if we actually, that's not too hard to quote, every 2 weeks we meet together, do a little reading, but if we actually met every 2 weeks and discussed a little bit about, you know, our service as husbands, or little hearing and chanting together. So if we do that as couples, you know, like right now, if we had just like a half-hour hearing and chanting session.
You could also pick out sections from the Chaitanya Charitamrita that are specifically about, you know, examples of grihasthas and how they dealt with certain situations, or things Prabhupada said in the Shikshamrita.
Yeah, that type of... So
that kind of
that
thing that's focused, you know, and hear and chant around that. Anishtagoshti.
Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman.